So, good evening from Winchester in the UK. My name's Andy Rice. It's late Saturday afternoon, early evening. And for Hamish, of course, it is early Sunday morning in New Zealand. Hi, Hamish, how are you doing?
Yeah, good, thanks. Yeah, it feels earlier and earlier these days because it's completely dark outside now. Although there is a full moon, so it's got it, there is that light around, which is yeah, it's nice to see. But it feels earlier and earlier.
Now, we were originally going to have this call at a different time because you were going to be having a bit of lie-in after the morning after the night before because your daughter Anna was due to get married yesterday, but then COVID restrictions prevented that from happening. So update us on the wedding and update us on life in general at the moment in Auckland, Hamish.
Yeah, well, it was a big concert in which Anna was going to get married, and they probably did the right thing because we had this sort of small lockdown a couple of weeks ago when they, or a month ago when they cancelled it, and we've now got a big lockdown, a week long, started as of last night, and so yeah, it was probably prudent that the organisers cancelled that music festival, and that's not cancelled though, it's postponed. So it's all go for another month from now for her wedding.
Right, okay. And so tell us about the lockdown. I literally hadn't heard anything about that. What's the latest on that?
Well, yeah, it's a bit of a surprise. We had an outbreak. Well, it seems to have been an outbreak that hasn't been contained. And I haven't looked at the news this morning, but we saw sort of messages coming in from friends as we went to bed last night that our Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern was actually a bit tearful, was saying that the outbreak that they thought had been contained hasn't been, and so they've locked everybody down for a week, starting as today, this morning.
Right, okay. So what does this mean for the America's Cup?
Yeah, well, it means we're really lucky. It's funny because I've got two hats on. I'm seeing all the very upset messages from the Olympic sailors who are locked down. They can't go sailing, but the America's Cup has got an exemption as a essential service. So we are actually working. We'll have to, obey protocols. We've worked in the lockdown at this level before. If it goes to a higher level, we have to shut down. But at the level we're at now, level three, we are able to work and go sailing. But we are the only, sort of leisure activity that is going sailing on the water at the moment.
Wow, hanging on by the skin of your teeth. So we are about a week away from the start of the America's Cup match. Obviously that is maybe there's a few more balls in the air because of what you've just told us, but how do you feel personally and how do you feel as a team with the match so close now?
Well, it's really interesting. I was watching the forecast. Obviously we're all watching the forecast, but more particularly in my area, and there's a sort of an index which measures the tropical turbulence. It's called the MJO index, and it went into a state which sets up a whole bunch of tropical storms throughout the next week. All forming one right above Darwin, another one right between in the Coral Sea, and another one forms near on the other side of New Caledonia between Fiji and New Caledonia, and they're all bombing towards New Zealand. And then we also have a situation where the blocking high that sat over New Zealand for the last month, right through all the America's Cup, Prada Cup challenging series, finally dissipates, and we're getting hit by these typical low pressure systems coming out of the Southern Ocean around the bottom of Tasmania. So we're just going to get bombarded for a week, and it looks too windy to sail on Saturday, conservatively 20 to 30 knots, and that's without any gusts. So we're well over the wind limits, the new wind limits being 21 knots now. And then Sunday's quite upper end. And then all through the week, we got these strong southwesterlies throughout the first week of the regatta. So completely different to what we've seen in the last 4 weeks.
Is it possible that the America's Cup could be curtailed in terms of the number of matches that determine the outcome?
I think it just keeps going, actually. I'll need to go back and read the sailing instructions on that, but I'm pretty sure that we just keep going until someone wins seven races. So in the beginning, the schedule is like, I think it's a 3 days with a day or two off, and you'll probably have it there. But once we get behind, and once we get to the weekend of the, I think it's the 13th and 14th of February, we're into a full block of races, day after day after day, until it concludes.
Okay, right. Well, meanwhile, I see we've got a lot of familiar faces that have been very loyal to these Q&A calls all the way through, and we've got a couple of new names as well. So hello to the regulars, and hello to some of our new attendees. And in particular, I want to say hello to Tom Burnham. So, Tom, it was delighted to have you sign up to Road to Gold in the first place. One of the best pro sailors in the world, one of the best pro coaches. I don't know if we can bring you in on the call a little bit later on, but just want to say hello to you, Tom. Let us kick off with the questions. We are, for those that have followed this all the way through from the day that we opened it on, I think it was something like 2nd of December or something like that. Fantastic achievement to have followed it as closely as you have, chapter by chapter. But for those of you that have still halfway through, or some of you who have just joined this week, Road to Gold for the first time, welcome to you. This is a rolling program. You do it in your own time. But our special subject this week is chapter 12. It's the concluding chapter of Road to Gold, which is all about racing. It took us a long time to get there. But Hamish is a stickler for doing your homework first before you get on the race course, as you well know. So we've received some questions in advance, also a lot of feedback from people, which we really appreciate. It's been fantastic to get your feedback, and it's been very positive. And we've also had some good critical feedback about how we can make it better as well. So we're taking that on board. Let's start off with a question from Eugen. Let's see if Eugen's on the call. I'm not sure that I've seen your name. I don't think I have. But Eugen says, I'm curious about the vocabulary used by the best teams to call shifts and gusts and all kind of other tactical information on the water. Also, passing on info from the boat, e.g. pressure in the kite to the helm. Are there effective, proven protocols to solve this problem? We have got a few other people on the call that would be good for answering this. But Hamish, I know that you've got lots you could say about this. The effectiveness of communication is what we're about.
Yeah, well, it's been really apparent in the America's Cup how people have improved the communication on board. You know, we've seen a massive gains there across all teams, particularly Lunarosa. They went away and really, you know, turned things around on the communication and brought more people in on the loop as well. And one of the great things about this question is that you can now, through the America's Cup, listen to all the onboard comms as they sail around the course, and you can get a really clear understanding of how they are communicating about all these quite technical things, and, you know, particularly with regard to the wind, because the wind is the same for every pro sailor, every sailor around the world. There's a lot of things they talk about which are specific to making the boat go fast, which may or may not be appropriate for other classes, but certainly around the wind and the manoeuvres they're going to do coming into marks or coming into a boat-on-boat situation are really worth listening to and understanding how, you know, there's a lot of similarities between the teams, even though the Italian team's doing all its communication in English. So you're getting, you know, listening to the communications on board, communications, you're getting a real understanding of how they're going about it.
Yeah, and I suppose when you think about it, the communications in English are all for the benefit of Jimmy Spithill, because I'm guessing everybody else on that boat would be able to speak Italian. And if they were speaking Italian, you at Emirates Team New Zealand wouldn't be able to understand quite so easily what it is that they were communicating between each other. I imagine that for you from the outside as the defender, listening to what the challengers have been saying during the Prada Cup must have been incredibly valuable intel for you.
Exactly. Yeah, and it's and you can really understand what they're actually dealing with on board when you hear the communications, and likewise they would be understanding what we're dealing with. So you understand more about the strengths and weaknesses of a team, knowing, you know, what they're talking about with regard to manoeuvres and where their foils are and what they're doing with their foils. And so there's a lot of, you know, it's like reading between the lines. There's a real insight there.
And we've heard various calls coming towards the leeward gate, the JK, that's the roundup and immediate tack. I think we know what that one is. Just tell us, Hamish, the JK is, why is it called that?
Yeah, well, I guess it's John. I don't know, actually. I'm assuming it's just named after John Kosicki, but I don't really know. I've never thought about where it derives from. But, yeah, there's a lot of people where, you know, clearly you need to shorten and make things very precise. So when you talk about the onboard comms and when we discuss it afterwards in a debrief, we're always thinking of how can we make it clearer, because there's no point in, you know, having a phrase where if you miss the first word of the phrase, then it becomes another maneuver. That's probably the most at-risk bit of information you could have. So you know, that needs to be changed. So it needs to be clearly, very clear. Even if you've missed one word at the start of it, it's still clear to everybody on board what their maneuver is going to be.
Tom Burnham, if you'd like to join us, I'm sure that you've studied communication with all the teams that you've raced with and coached. So I'll just give you a moment to see if you do want to come in. And of course, you don't have to. Meanwhile, while we wait to see what Tom's response is, just remember the chat box is there for you to use. And we hope to get questions through from you on the chat box. Don't be shy. This is your moment. So I'm not sure if Tom's going to come in on this one.
I'm here, Andy.
Hi, Tom.
Yeah,
how are you doing? Lovely to see you.
Yeah. Hey, Hamish.
Hey.
Hi. So yeah, I think what Hamish said is really appropriate, and it's something that I work a lot with the teams that I'm coaching, is listening to what they're talking about, recording their onboard communications, and then replaying that for them with video in the debrief, so that everybody you can learn so much from it, and being precise and clear and using those sort of terminology like the JK or the Eagle. You know, the guys have the Chicago is another top mark rounding that came from one of the World Series events during the last cup, and the JK came from San Francisco when John Kostecki always wanted to do the foiling turn up into attack in San Fran, and those names came from different things. But I think it makes it clearer for the guys, especially in these higher speed boats where you don't have time to explain it in a long drawn out manner. So it is an important way to kind of call a play like that. And everybody knows what's going to happen and they all know their roles. So I think it's an important part of it. But the recording and I'm sure Hamish is listening to the guys live while they're sailing around as well, which is even really helpful. I know that I try and do that as much as I can when I'm coaching, so you can get a feel for what's happening on the boat. And then when you go talk to them afterwards, you have a context of being able to talk to them about what they've been discussing on board. It's a big part of the big help for coaching. That's for sure. I know it helps for me a lot. In Bermuda during the last America's Cup, that was a big one for me with the Artemis team.
Tom, for those that don't know, you just give us a quick potted history of your CV, what you've done over the years and what you've been doing more recently.
Well, I've done 3 America's Cups as a sailor, a couple of them with Luna Rossa with Hamish. And then one is the coach of the Artemis team in Bermuda for the last America's Cup. And then I've been sailing and coaching a bit with Quantum Racing TP52 and World Match Racing Tour. I'd coached the Sail GP team from Team USA for the first season. I'll be working with the Australian team a little bit this year with Tom Slingsby. And so sort of a little bit of everything, helping out with the Olympic team here in the States a bit too. So keeping busy with some coaching and sailing.
Excellent. Okay. So yeah, both of you have walked the walk as well as talking the talk. Just stay on for a little bit. Yep. Tom, I'd like you and Hamish to have a chat about what you think works and doesn't work. And one of Eugen's specifics was passing on info from the boat, e.g. pressure in the kite to the helm. For example, should the guy trimming the kite be telling the helm what to do, or is it more a matter of just feeding back the pressure and leaving the final decision to the helm? I'll let Hamish start with that, and then Tom, maybe you can pitch in on that.
Yeah, I think in a small dinghy, like, you know, a 470 as an example, you know, you really have the helmsman really is tuned into the trimmer, because there's a moment there where, you know, if you're in light air, if you steer it, you know, a few degrees or carry on even with the same course, if you're not responding to the trimmer, then the kite will collapse. So, and then, you know, you have a large drawn out process to get it all going again. And remember that boat speed is, you know, is contributing as much to the wind speed as anything else. So yeah, in a dinghy for sure. And I think, I'm sure Tom will have a better, you know, how that loop works on a pro big pro boat. Tom, over to you.
Yeah, I think it's on a bigger boat, it's probably more of, especially with an owner driver, there's a lot of kind of coaching the angle in terms of usually calling up and down. You kind of say it in degrees, but you kind of just figure out your system up two, up three, whatever it is, and you kind of hone in on what those numbers mean with between the trimmer and the helm. And one of the biggest ones that we've found recently as well is that it's also really important to reinforce when the angle is correct, to say, you know, keep great angle here, keep going straight, you know, not it's really easy to say no higher or no lower because you think that that is going to translate well, but it's almost better to just say going straight here, keep going straight, and just keeping as clear and as simple as possible. And I think one of the big ones that we work on with the bigger boats, the TP52s and the mini maxis and things is keeping that comms coming and not understanding that it's not a criticism of, it's a feedback thing. And it's not that you're trying to teach these people how to do it necessarily. It's more that they're the guy with the sheet on the sailor with the sheet in their hand. He or she is going to have a better feel for that angle than the helm a lot of the time in a bigger boat. In the small boats, I think what Hamish is saying is that it's really helm. The helm is trimming a lot of the time, really, aren't they? On a 49er or something, especially just by their steering.
Exactly.
So also to both of you, how important is it on a bigger boat that everybody is engaged in the tactical process? Because obviously the bigger the boat, the smaller your respective role is, and people sometimes have a chit chat on the rail when you start to getting to a crew size of say 7 or larger. Starting with Hamish again and then on to Tom, how important is it, if at all, that everybody is engaged in the tactical decision making, Hamish?
Well, I think it's all the sailors on the boat should be engaged in the whole, you know, racing side of things. It's as much as they can, because more eyes are great, but you'll find as the teams progress that there's a real respect for how that information goes back down the rail, if you like, or when somebody chips in, it's, you know, it's got to be clear that it's, you know, a bit of an eye contact and, you know, and you've kind of, yeah, I've got that, you know, sort of goes along. You don't need a lot of, I mean, a good boat, you're always working towards a quiet boat as much as you can, but everybody gets tuned into the same thing. That's your kind of overall goal. And initially it might be a bit, you know, people chirping in from here, there, everywhere is maybe how it starts, but you really, you know, you want to move the thing towards a real quiet boat where everybody from the front to the back completely tuned into the race and should know what the next move's going to be. That's how I'd sum it up, I think, because otherwise you have the opportunity of missing something. And, you know, Tom remembers, oh, I don't know if you're on that one, but I remember when I was standing with Russell Coutts as a strategist, and we were charging down and towards the finish of a race in this Louis Vuitton series they had, where we evened out the boats and we all jumped on board, and we were well ahead of the other boat in a match race, and all we needed to do was jibe for the favoured end of the line, and no one's pointed out that end was favoured, and it was a long finish line, and we were still on starboard heading towards the wrong end, the downwind end of the line. And I remember Russell he showed no mercy. You know, we had 18 people on the boat and not a single person, you know, managed to speak up and say, hey, we're the other end's favoured, you know. So there's a really good example of why you want as many people tuned in as possible, so things don't fall in through the cracks.
Tom?
Yeah,
Tom, any follow-up on that from you in terms of, I imagine at the pro level, TP52s, everyone is so professional that they are naturally engaged in the process. But for a lot of the people on Road to Gold who are keen weekend warriors, keeping their people engaged in the process is maybe harder for them than it is at the pro level. Any tips and feedback for them?
Yeah, I think that what Hamish is saying is really great. I think that there's a couple of different things. For me, it's important that the crew are engaged enough that they are thinking ahead to what the next maneuver is going to be. That if they see what the wind direction is or the compass heading is on the instruments and are thinking ahead, like, ooh, it might be a jibe setup here. That's a pretty big right shift, or you know, and how that affects their roles on the boat. Even if you're a bowman or a pitman, it's really nice to be thinking about these things. And then to Hamish's point, I'm a huge fan of making sure that people are prompting things if they don't hear what they should be hearing around the racetrack. You know, when you're getting up close to the top mark, hey, what are you guys thinking back there for the rounding? It's a right shift, maybe a jibe set up here, you know, question mark. And it sort of helps prompt those discussions, the same as going down that final run. Hey, what, you know, it's a lefty, you know, maybe the pin's going to be favored at the finish down here. What are we going for? You know, asking that question to prompt the response, because it's easy to take for granted that the guys and the people in the afterguard are going to be on top of everything. And it's easy for people to miss things. So asking the question a lot of times can really promote the thinking and make people realize that, oh yeah, we got to remember those basics. So that's good.
Thank you for that, guys. Maybe this is a silly question, but I'm wondering about communication for single handers. What's the conversation loop that we have in our own heads when we're sailing a single hander? So I wonder if Lily Zhu or John Emmett might have a comment on that. You've both won things at the highest level in single handers. So if either Lily and or John wants to come in on that and tell us maybe sometimes the conversation loop that you have to have with yourself to make sure that you're thinking about all aspects of the race course. Want to come in on that, John?
Yeah, I can do. Was just waiting to see if Lily had something first.
Well, let's see if Lily does come in. But you work with a number of single-handed athletes. I'm sure they have different approaches to the same problem. And you yourself have won world championships in the radial. Is it something that you work on, communication with yourself, or is that just overthinking it?
Well, I think there's two things. In a racing context, you absolutely have to think ahead, because what you do half a boat length past the windward mark can just decide your entire downwind leg. You know, if you want to go hard way or hard another way, you've got to make that decision on your windward mark approach, which means you might have to be thinking of it, you know, 8 boat lengths before the windward mark, which in boats which go as slow as lasers, that's a long time out. But in terms of communication in training, it's really important, especially when you work in multi-nation training teams, that everybody knows what you're going to go out and do and what you're trying to achieve and how the exercises are going to work, and also the bigger picture, so you're working what you really need to work on to do well at, for example, this year, the Olympic Games. Rather than just going out and going sailing, you know, you're working on your weaknesses and you're making the best of each day. But I think for boats like lasers, you do need to look at something like one regatta a month just to keep those sailing skills sharp. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens now when we've had just so little racing compared to normal years.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you very much for that, guys. I hope Eugene finds some of that helpful. Let's ask some questions that have come in from Peter Hall. How best to optimize the run jibing on wind shifts? Hamish, this I've always found this tricky. It's not like picking out wind shifts when you've got the sails pulled in hard going upwind. You've got so many moving parts going downwind, sailing a free leg of the course. So how do you work out when to jibe on the wind shifts downwind?
I think like upwind, you know, one of your biggest tools is the sort of the big picture tool, where you're looking at angles. You know, you sort of take the assumption, particularly at the front end of the fleet, you know, that everybody's sailing good angles. You know, assuming that you're in a one design type boat, And you can tell by the angles how that, you know, where the wind's sitting on the course, just as you would upwind. So you'll imagine where those puffs are, and those different angles represent how the direction's changing within the pressure on across the run. And you can tell, you know, where the lifts and the knocks are. So that's your kind of go-to immediately, you know, sort of the big picture go-to, and for me anyway. And then, of course, within that, you know, you're looking at the, if you've got the ability to look at the compass, or you're looking at the land, you know, like a transit through the forestay, and you can see when you're getting, you know, lifted, and it's the more you get lifted, the more likely you want to jibe, and it's going to depend a little bit on how much runway you've got left, you know, in front of you, because the ley line's coming up to the bottom mark, and you want to establish too how, you know, how hot, you probably hear that saying, you know, you want to come into that mark, and a lot of that depends on how compressed you are in the fleet, or whether you've got a little bit of a lead, and also whether you think the wind is dying a bit, or the breeze is coming up a little bit. You know, if you think the breeze is coming up a bit, then your runways might have already run out, you know, and coming in hot's not a good option. But if you think the breeze is dropping a little bit, and you're quite compressed in the fleet, there's often, you know, some really nice gains to be made coming in fast at the bottom mark. When the nervous thing is for people to try to jibe early and, you know, and end up getting compressed above the bottom mark. And that's a braver person with a lot more maybe risk, but also a lot more potential gain who leaves it later and comes in faster. So there's those things to consider as another layer over the wind shifts as well.
Presumably, it's a little bit easier working out these wind shifts in a displacement boat or a boat with a symmetrical spinnaker. Maybe harder with an asymmetric, would you say?
Yeah, well, it's just different because, you know, downwind, it's there's not a lot of gas. People are just, you know, they're pretty conscious of where they need to jibe in relation to each other. So you tend to survive in lanes of your own. Whereas when you're going down in the conventional spinnaker, there's a lot, you know, it's a lot harder to find, or with a single-handed boat, it's sort of harder to find those clear lanes of wind, and you're focused a lot on them. Whereas you're hooning along with a asymmetric, you know that if the boat in front of you jibes, well, you know you can jibe immediately, or you need to wait so many boat lengths and you can jibe beside them. So you're kind of already gauging the clear air aspect is a little more easier to understand once the breeze is in with an asymmetric. And so therefore you can't maneuver as many times because you lose more in a maneuver. You really kind of get committed to certain formulas, you know, whereas if you would never jibe set unless you were well in the bottom half of the fleet, typically, because you're going to have to run through the gas of all the starboard tackers on the beat. But that's a great move if you're further back in the fleet, a jibe set. So typically you're jibing and, I mean, you're bearing away and setting if you're in the front half of the fleet and looking for an opportunity on a shift or a pattern that's established itself from the first beat where you might want to pick to jibe coming back.
Great, thank you. Now, in terms of your target regatta for the year for Olympic sailors, that, and if they're qualified for the Games, they know what their target regatta is. But one of the things we talk about on the recorded calls is other peaks that you would set for yourself during the season. But you also say if you're bouncing from regatta to regatta, let's say it's the sort of European season going from here to say the old Spa Medemblik regatta to Kiel, and things aren't going well for you, then you need to find some time out. Just tell us about the balance that you try to draw between your target regattas, the regattas where you're trying to score a result as opposed to where you're working on specific goals, where it's a process regatta.
Yeah, and it's not unusual to, you know, in my thinking, to just take a sailor out of a regatta and do some more training. If you see things aren't really, they're not really progressing enough in these areas on the race course, it can be a really confidence building to say, okay, well, we can see that they're not progressing on the race course because these things are lacking. And, it's the obvious one is speed. You can't progress in a race if you aren't fast enough. And so therefore you can, it become a real positive thing to say, well, let's just go away and work on this block, work on speed and the sea state that we know is a clear gap in our repertoire. And that can be really much better, more productive than just bashing your head against the wall and trying another regatta where it's not going to work. If they strike those wind conditions or sea state conditions, they're going to have another failure. And we're not, the key to the road to gold is learning to win. And it's, sending yourself out there is like a boxer, going out against an opponent where they know they're going to get knocked down and knocked out. And it's not the right thing to do. We're trying to work all the time with our foundation to improve our skills to a level where we don't need to get knocked out. We're fast enough to be able to hold a lane anywhere on the course, and it allows us to learn to win. And I think the worst thing that can happen if you're not got the preparation is you're going to learn to lose.
Okay. And so where is that cutoff point? At what point does the performance get so bad that you decide to intervene and you say, look, guys, this is going to work against you if you carry on this way. We need to get you out of the regatta mode and get you into training mode, even though it's mid-season.
Yeah, I think it becomes very obvious when you can identify with the sailors that exactly what's going wrong. If there's a starting issue or if it's like a boat speed issue, then it really works if you clearly identify what's going on to move them out of that and then just plug that gap instead of doing the next event. But within the period between events, we quite often end up identifying these things and saying, okay, well, we can work on them separated out from the event. So you're quite often it's good to go to a different, what you've got to do is draw a line in the sand between the next event and the training period. And I've always found, I don't know how it is for Tom, but the better the training period is before a regatta, the worse the result will be in the regatta. So if there's a huge amount, say, learned around boat speed leading up to an important regatta at that venue, you've really focused and you've gotten, maneuvers and boat speed sorted out at that venue. Unless you can get the sailing team to transition into race mode, they'll take all this crap, all this stuff in their heads about batten tensions and tuning and, four-stay tensions and all this stuff that they've learned beautifully during your training period will flow over into the race period and it'll become a poor regatta in my experience. So it's really, really important to divide off the race period to the training period and have a transition somehow, whether it's a break. You say, okay, we're going to go away now for a couple of days. We're going to focus on a whole bunch of things that are important about winning this regatta. So you might give them, the playbook for the weather. And this is the playbook for Palma. This is how the strategy plays out. Go away for 2 days, start visualizing. The forecast looks like this. So start visualizing how we're going to win next week when this regatta starts. That could be a really good way of drawing a line in the sand to get yourself, the whole team away from the training period and into the racing period.
Did anybody else's eyebrows go up when they heard Hamish say that can spill over, all this crap can spill over? I mean, that to me is quite surprising, that good findings, good learnings during a training period can actually put you off your game for the racing. Anyone else want to drop anything into the chat box there? And does John or Tom want to comment on that? Does that chime with the way that you've worked with your sailors when you've been coaching them?
I'll jump in quick. Yeah, it definitely is a factor, and you have to be, as Hamish was saying, you have to be wary of it. And I guess a lot of the teams that I work with are shorter. We don't have as much time as like an Olympic program would, a full-time Olympic program. So at a TP52 event or an RC44, you've only got a few days of training leading up to the regatta. So you have to, it's less of an issue, I think, because we do need to have, we need to split those things happening in only in a 3 or 4 day period before the event. And there's not the luxury of being able to take time off. But one of the things that I like to do to make that transition from the, okay, we're in speed mode is to have a good, you know, kind of coaches regatta sort of practice race. Like I think somebody just put it in the chat the day before the racing starts to get everybody's mind thinking about it, but also reviewing some the weather and the current and the sort of local effects, like Hamish was saying, is a really great way to get people thinking again, the team thinking, and then and also reviewing potentially you might have been training in 3 or 4 days in sort of light air, but the first day of the regatta is going to be a windy one. So you need to go back and look at some video and photos from a windy day from a previous event to just get the heads around, because it's easy to keep always be debriefing what you've already done instead of looking forward and making sure that you're prepared for that the challenge that's going to be coming to you on the first day of the event or the next day or whatever.
And you raise an interesting point. Even though we think of TP52s and RC44s as very high level, and certainly they are with the caliber of sailor that competes in those regattas, but you are on a very short run in terms of time. So prioritizing your goals must be incredibly important in that situation, Tom.
Yeah, you definitely need to have a good list of what are the goals of each session prior to the regatta. And it's you have to balance that the long-term goals of continuing to improve through the season as well as the short-term goal of performing well in the regatta that's coming up in a couple of days time. But yeah, the events are usually the first event of the season in both those classes. You get an unlimited training block, but then after that, the amount of days you're allowed to train in the 44 and the 52 are limited by the sailing instructions to, I think it's 3 days in the 52 and 2 days in the 44. So it's not a lot of time really over the season.
Are there some benefits to being forced to focus the mind and focus your time in that way?
I think so. You can easily overdo it and have a team that shows up at a regatta pretty tired and not rested, because you do, even when you had more unlimited time previously, it would still only be 4, maybe 5 days. And it's still not enough that you show up, do 3 or 4 days, and then have a day or two off before the regatta starts. So it easily turns into 10 days straight of sailing hard and you know, with everybody flying in from all around the world, you can easily overdo it and turn up on the third day of racing pretty exhausted. But so yeah, it is good to have to focus what you're doing. And usually it leads to a pretty planned and scheduled upgrades throughout the season, so that you know you have a new sail coming online at event 3 and you have to put some time on that sail and then have it ready for event 4. And there's definitely has to be a plan in place, because you don't have the luxury of just adding more training days if you think you need to work on something.
And with this COVID period, when everybody eventually does come back onto the race course very under practiced, what's your prediction about who's going to do well? I don't mean the specific boat, but I mean, what are the things that people will have done well as a crew to make sure that they come out of the blocks faster than their rivals?
In my opinion, I think that hopefully they were listening to Hamish on these calls and reading your stories and watching all the data here. I think it's really helpful, but just keeping our heads in the game is a really hard part throughout this whole thing. And there's been a lot of people that are able to get sailing. I know here in Newport, Rhode Island, we were able to do a bunch of sailing last summer. And even if it was out by ourselves and in small boats or whatever, but just keeping your heads in the game has been a really important part of it. And it'll be interesting when all these boats get back on the race course, because there will be some relearning of things that you've already learned in the past, but have forgotten in the 18 months. And, you know, hopefully the coaches and the sailors have been done a good job of keeping good notes of what they did in the past, so that when they do return, that all those little things that make a difference, you've remembered, you don't forget them. And that's That's a big Ian Percy thing of the cheat sheets, of having your little cheat sheet. Each person has a little notebook that of little reminders that they have for themselves. And I think that that's, those cheat sheets are huge and really help you when you show up at an event after not having practiced. Or, you know, the other example of you could do two events in a row in a 52 or a 44 where it's really light air. And you might forget that three events earlier, there was a windy one in Marstrand or something like that. And so having those little notes that you remember those tricks and tips from the heavy air and just reading them through quickly before you head out on the water makes a huge difference. You don't make those same mistakes again.
Well, you've given some great endorsement to the road to gold processing, including the importance of cheat sheets, which I want to ask Hamish a little bit more about in a moment. Very quickly, Tom, do you prefer electronic or paper-based for recording your captures and your learnings? And then the cheat sheets, are they laminated or what are they?
It depends. I prefer using my phone. I take a lot of notes on my phone and I kind of organize them based on the different boats. And I can and each venue has its own notes in my iPhone notes app. And I just like to have them in there because then it's always stored in the cloud and you don't lose your wet notes book. And the phones seem to be waterproof enough these days that you can do that. The cheat sheets can be just in your phone. Again, you can have your little cheat sheets in the phone, or it could be laminated during the last cup. Ian would make his cheat sheets and laminate them and he'd have them in his life jacket pocket and he'd pull them out and remember, all right, you can't do a bear away and do a jibe and this much wind or whatever, you know, those little reminders to himself and then there are individual things. They're not necessarily position based on the boat. They're things that trigger your memory. So it's something that you personally come up with so that you triggers yourself to remember these things the next time you get out in that condition.
Great. Tom, thank you very much for that. Hamish, it's almost like we primed Tom with those quotes before we got him on the call. We couldn't have asked for better. Russell Coutts was less than complimentary about your boat preparation skills back in your teenage days, Hamish, and you obviously got on top of that because boat maintenance comes up very early in the road to gold. What were you like with cheat sheets and recording info in your early days?
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I think that was one of the strengths we had, I remember Dave Barnes's red book. You know, I mean, a lot of people would have loved to have gotten their hands on that red book. You know, he always seemed to have it around the dinghy park and be writing little reminders in it and little discoveries on his journey. You know, and I think it was probably the hottest property in the 470 world for a long, long time. People talked about the red book, but yeah, no, I always wrote a diary, and I've always written a diary. I still write a diary. Yeah, obviously things have become, you know, more electronic these days, but really, you know, the exactly what, you know, I couldn't have said it better. You know, exactly what Tom said. You know, you break it down and you have your reminders, and that's what gets you to perform under pressure and not let things fall through the cracks.
And what Tom said about Ian Percy keeping stuff in his life jacket, that surprised me. But let me ask you, do you think part of the reason, especially when you're sailing high pressure, high speed boats like we've seen in the last 10 years of the America's Cup, is it that you're in sensory overload? You're in such a new environment. You're learning by the leg, if not by the minute, that you need reference points because the head's already got enough to deal with. Is that part of what cheat sheets are about?
I think it is. You know, it's a priority thing. And, you know, in any given day, there's probably 100 things a sailor can sort of be conscious of to improve their performance around the race course. But if you started at the back, you know, 50 of those, which might be, you know, batten tension or, you know, polishing the rudder a bit more, or, you know, detailing the leading edge of your foils, you know, and it's a windy, strong southwest day offshore day that, you know, it's, you know, clearly not the right 50 to be focusing on. So I think it's really a case of these, you know, I call them like performance cheat sheets, and every day is going to have a different list, you know, based on the conditions. which bring you to the priorities that are going to win you that day. Sort of priority one, priority two, priority three. On a sea breeze day when the wind's not shifting, your first priority is going to be making sure that you are fast enough to be able to manage to sail next to anyone in the fleet. So your lead into that is whatever. And the next step is you're going to have to get off the line. You know, it's a huge priority. If you don't make it a front row start, well, you might as well sail in, because it's, one of those days. And we've talked about this a lot, but it's always knowing what the priorities are and those performance cheat sheets. And I always like to put that performance in front of them, is always with that in mind. It's bringing out the right priorities to perform under those different environments.
Yeah. It's been a really strong message that has really come home to me. And I just want to thank Russ Clark for getting Howie Hamlin's permission to share Howie's cheat sheet in the chapter that we've just published. So if you haven't seen that already, I think you'll get a lot out of Howie Hamlin's cheat sheet. That was very enlightening. And the one that we've shared as the Road to Gold debrief sheet is, I think, a phenomenal tool as well. So I hope you get the most out of that. I want to thank also Kevin Kenny for turning a lot of the information from previous chapters into cheat sheets. And we would love it if anybody else wants to share what they've sort of been putting together on our behalf. And I see that our host Benedict has just dropped in the regatta routine checklist. I think that's the Howie one. Some really good info in there, and this seems to be coming through really, really strongly. And for those that kept cheat sheets and recordings and notes going into the unexpectedly long COVID period, I think that's going to put them at a great advantage when we do come out of the end of COVID, when we're all trying to remember what it was that we used to do and which hand we hold the tiller in and all the rest of it. I've got a specific question from South Africa from Michael and Heidi Kavanagh about venue information. And actually this is Lake Garda, but this is for the top end of Lake Garda. So we spoke about Malchesnay a couple of weeks ago. Michael has heard that it can be a one-sided race course and that you need to be rigged and ready for a quick launch and race start once the afternoon thermal breeze kicks in. Very quickly, Hamish, we've dealt with Garda a little bit, but the top end of Garda, where it's more of a go-right course, anything you want to say about that?
Yeah, the Riva Torvali. It is. It's, you get that afternoon thermal that fall that comes up over the edge and funnels down towards Riva and Torvali, and you don't always get it, so you can't bank on it. But certainly in the summer months, in general, it's going to be there. And the cliffs on the right hand side, the dominant feature compared to the sort of lower, more gradually sloping slopes around the Torvali side, and that basically compresses the breeze on that cliff side. And it's pretty much, do what you can. It depends on the type of boat you're sailing, but do what you can to use that breeze, that stronger wind on the right.
Yeah, so I see Bruce Keane is on the call. He won the Musto Skiff Worlds there in 2015, but it was very untypical when we were doing that. I don't know if you want to come in on this one, Bruce. Let's see if you do. Yes, I think you're in already.
Yeah.
Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Andy. Yeah, you're right. I think we had the pre-worlds was the typical kind of Garda conditions. And it was described to me beforehand as like a conveyor belt. You get into the cliffs first and you just the rich get richer. And we definitely saw that in the pre-worlds races. And it's surprising.
Sorry, Bruce. Could you just switch your video on if you are able to?
Not easily.
No, fair enough. You keep on going. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, so that definitely, I mean, just the sooner you got across, so, somebody tacked two boat lengths before you, there would be five boat lengths ahead of you by the time they got into the cliff. So it made a massive difference. I would say where we were sailing, you didn't necessarily want to get right the way in, because I remember we were up near the windsurf school and you'd kind of run out of breeze if you got a bit too close. But that definitely paid. But yeah, the rest of the time it was all over the show and just kind of looking out of the boat, it didn't necessarily pay, the same beat each time. It was just very variable. So you can expect anything when it's like that.
Yeah, that to me was really unexpected. I mean, Hamish, I would think that, well, we've got our Worlds there, hopefully back again in the Musto Skiffs later on this year in October. They've been pushed back to October. So that's what Bruce and I and many others are lining up for. But I'm thinking that I do need to work on my committee boat end starts. And I'm not afraid to have a go at the port tack start, as Musto Skiff sailors know. So I've got that one in my repertoire. But the committee boat end start, that would be a good use of time, wouldn't it, for Garda?
Yeah, and I think, October's getting pretty late in the season. So I think, you could also prepare for those kind of unexpected conditions where the breeze can be, trying to get into the lake from every direction. And it's, it's sort of not over till it's over. Those kind of days, snakes and ladders, as you like to call them, are also more likely later in the off season outside of the summer months. So, but then there's a breeze that drains in the morning, where you might be up for an 8 o'clock start and you're getting the cold air draining out of the mountains the other way, from the north. So, don't be surprised to see a few of those, a few of those races as well with the wind from the north and an early morning start.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I've done some of those in the 49er as well. And there's an extra weight to that wind when it's coming from the north. It feels colder and it feels like the gusts are stronger as well. Chris Loons. Hi, Chris. You've been one of our regulars. Would you like to come in and ask your question directly to Hamish? Let's see if Chris is here. Not sure. I'm going to read it out anyway, and let's see if Chris comes in. So it's, he's coming in. So I'm thinking Chris is asking about 505s specifically, but it's a good question anyway. It's about sail selection. Do you choose a different mainsail for a certain venue? And thank you, Nigel. The other side of Garda pays to go left upwind. Yes, Malchesnay, I think you might be referring to, and that certainly was a go left venue in my experience.
Can you hear me?
Yes, hear you. Hi, Chris. Good to see you.
And you. So my question really is slightly related to a Garda situation. So I do sail a 505, and we tend to be on the light side, and I'm considering whether a flatter main is more efficient when it gets windier than a standard main that might be depowered, with more Kickham or Cunningham. Now I haven't had an opportunity to test a flat main against a standard main, but in broad principles, would a flatter main be more efficient than a fuller main that had been flattened off?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and it's something we played with going into Los Angeles in the 470. We took a standard Ullman main, which was, it had the best all-round performance in the class at the time, and we customized it a bit for stronger sea breezes we expected in Los Angeles for the 84 Olympics. And doing that, we basically straightened out the exit a little bit more. We kept the depth pretty similar, but we took out a little bit of depth in terms of broad seam depth and added luff curve. So it ended up retaining the same amount of depth and straightening out the back, the leech area, rather than having it more frisbee shaped or having a lot of return in the leech itself. We made that exit angle much straighter, and it definitely improved our performance in the stronger wind.
Okay. That's interesting. And I do kind of feel like plenty of stuff from the 470 should translate to the 505, but it doesn't always feel that way.
Right.
I don't know what other people think, but, the 505 is clearly a scaled up version, but it doesn't seem that everything translates perhaps the way you might do. The same way the 420 doesn't always translate to a 470 either.
Exactly. You might find that someone's already done a good version, a good windy version of a main some other point.
Yeah.
Be really test it and see if you notice, you know, any performance improvement.
Yeah, fortunately, our training partner managed to order a flatter mane by accident, but so we will get a chance to have a look at it and see what it's like in some more breeze, but not until probably April, I guess, until COVID releases us.
Yeah, we're all under COVID now, aren't we?
Yeah. Yep. Thank you very much.
Good luck with that.
Chris, thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks very much for that. Now, I've got another question here, and this is about needing more experience in big fleets. There's quite a lot of opinion here. Not all of us may agree with it, but it's an interesting question. I've noticed that most dinghy racers appear to have very little emotion other than the odd bit of anger on the course. It doesn't look as if they want to be there, but their coaches have taught them to be able to lay it down on the track each race. I find it difficult to go from my local friendly club to the ragingly unfriendly place, which is the youth race course / professional adult races. Some classes are more fun than others, and so I sail those. But if I wanted to get somewhere big with my campaign, then I would have to race the dirtiest classes, e.g. Laser or 49er, where sportsmanship is regularly forgotten. So we don't necessarily have to agree with all of that, Hamish, but what if somebody is feeling that way, that they feel that getting into the really high-end competitive classes feels like an unfriendly place to be? Should they even be going there in the first place, do you think?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think there's no doubt about it that as you advance up the ladder in any sport, it's going to end up being, you know, more cutthroat, and you know, people are going to be more determined, and they're going to have invested more of themselves into this thing. So there's an imbalance going on. And, you know, it's not unusual for people to feel like that. And I think it depends so much on their competitive nature of that person as to which level they want to play the game at. And I see nothing wrong with playing the game at any of those levels. We're very lucky in sailing. As this person's rightfully said, you can pick a class, or you can pick an event, a regatta, and you can choose at what level you want to be involved or invested in. At the highest level, it is pro, it is professional. That's not to say that those particular events are any better or worse than another event in a different class that's not, is not like that. You've still got great sailors at every level, whether it's, you know, it can be just as hard to win your club champs. And, you know, I think of in my environment, you know, you go to jump in a Zephyr, if you like, which is a very recreational boat, and try to win the club champs at Murray's Bay, you're going to have a fairly good, you know, fairly good challenge ahead of you. So I think it's just a matter of picking what you really feel comfortable with in terms of, and don't get frustrated about it. It's just a reality. It's going to be more cutthroat. The more time people spend at it, the more invested they become in it, the more cutthroat it is. But a lot of those events, I look back with incredibly fond memories at the social side of all of those events as well. So I think there is a social program going on at every single level, but you have to sort of dig a little deeper to find the social program in some of the more professional classes would be a good summary.
Yeah, I hear the Laser Masters. They're struggling to keep their social program going there. They're mostly drinking orange juice in the Laser Masters, not a beer in the evening. But John Emmett, you might want to put me right on that if I'm wrong. Anyway, thank you for that. The other thing I would say is the faster the boat, generally the more people are live and let live, has been my experience, because in the faster boats, it's not so much about the inches and centimeters. So there tend to be fewer protests the faster the boat, has been my experience. Just another question. This is again a sort of a mental game question here for you, Hamish. I want the result. I know I'm capable, but sort of obsessed with it, that I make many unforced errors and don't focus on what is needed. I generally go into negative spirals in races where I focus on where I could have been if, rather than focusing on my boat. So they're talking about this negative snowball effect. Hamish, how do you address that if you find that you're obsessing about what just happened rather than what's about to happen?
It's a really good question, and it's something we've got to learn. That's a huge part of the mental skills chapter, and it's a huge part of every sport, is being able to move on. And I think having cue words is really good. If you're in a two-person boat, you can get the other person should be able to recognize, you know, this is a good time for a prompt here, you know, and you need to know how to phrase things to bring some positivity back into it. You know, it's the right time to crack a joke. It's always the right time, you know, when the pressure's up to have a laugh about something, you know, to break that tension and move on. So you're always looking for a sort of playbook of words that, you know, can be self-taught if you're in a single-handed class, where you say a few things that you know will get you back in the moment again and move you on from where you've been sitting mentally.
Excellent. Okay, thank you very much for that. Now we are just past time. Hamish, I don't know how you're doing. Do you need to get on and get moving?
No, we're all good. We're out sailing at the moment, so the day's waking up for us. The sun's looks like sun's up, but I think the wind's up too by the look of it.
We're laying with the tide.
Ulrika says we're laying with the tide.
Oh, right, the tide, okay.
Tide's stronger than the wind.
Oh, right. Well, it sounds like that's not going to be the case in a week's time when the America's Cup gets going.
No, I think it's your dogs off chains for race one.
Yeah. Now, Hamish, what do you think? We've got to the end of version one of Road to Gold, but it is a rolling program. We've done 12 live calls, but can we convince you to stay on maybe a week or two longer while the America's Cup is still rolling?
Yeah, no, I'd agree to that, as long as it's not a continued 6:30 a.m. program, because, well, A, it's dark, and B, we're shifting our body clocks at the moment into race program for Team Emirates Team New Zealand. So, you know, we're racing at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and we're probably still debriefing that day at 11 p.m. at night. So we're shifting to sort of Mediterranean time, and 6 a.m. in the morning for me is a bit early. So yeah, let's go 7:30, like an hour later.
All right, yeah, let's keep it going. Since we launched this, what has been the thing that's come home to you the most in terms of going through this program with people? Any observations?
I mean, I've just found that the contributions from the audience on these live Q&As has been really, really interesting for me to hear things from other people's perspectives. And you know, you end up, you know, we had that amazing moment with Santi Longhi, you know. And we've had many other similar moments where, you know, it was around transits, if I remember, start line transits. And I was feeling a little bit sheepish and saying, well, actually, you know, I don't really use a transit often, and Peter and Blair don't really either. And then Santi chimed in, said, I've never used a transit either. So, you know, I think there's moments like that where they were priceless moments. And so they're, you know, there's certainly been a lot of learnings from my perspective throughout it all. And you know, I think that's the whole beauty of what we're putting down here on the table, is that I think that interaction between all these really, really good sailing brains and being able to, you know, structure it in such a way that it's easy to understand chapter by chapter the workings we need to do. And I really hope that we can organize this test, Andy, so that we can see a visual, you know, people could actually take a test and plug it into a little program where, you know, you've got five pillars of learning within each of those 12 chapters. And then there's the three win categories within those five pillars of learning. So you'll end up seeing a score of just where your gaps are across all that learning and know where you need to work. So I think that'd be.
Yeah, we are still working on the test, so that we will be coming through with that. We are also very open to other suggestions and ideas. We've quite early on implemented subtitles into the videos to help people, particularly for whom English is not their first language. So we are making innovations and making additions. So any of those things where you can help us fill in the gaps on Road to Gold, we really appreciate that. And there are a number of people that I could thank in terms of their contributions already. And if I name some, I'm gonna miss out the others. But I think some of you know who you are anyway. So I thank you very much for that. And I want to congratulate those of you that have made it through to the end of Road to Gold, that have followed it week by week since the day that we launched this program, because you have been really committed to the process over these 12 weeks, and it's been great to go along with you on that. But at the same time, for the people that have got on board more recently, it's great to have you in here, and we will be always open to communication with you about any aspect of Road to Gold. We want it to be as interactive as it can be. And it's a different thing for everybody, depending on where we are with our sailing. So Martin has written in with a lot of feedback about how we might make Road to Gold more specific for weekend warriors as opposed to full-time Olympic sailors, let's say. So there are things that we can address there. It's difficult to make Road to Gold all things to all people. It'll never quite be that. But the fundamental thing is, if you're serious about improving your sailing and your skills on the race course at whatever level you're at, then I still believe that Hamish's structure, the 12-chapter structure, will work for you at any level of the sport. And that seems to be the feedback that we've got. So Hamish, I congratulate you on creating that structure all that time ago. And I think maybe it comes back to when you were working with the Japanese, when there was that language barrier. It had to be clear and it had to be understandable.
Yeah, and it had to be connected. I think, you know, I think that's the key to it, is that, you know, there's a set of priorities that, you know, the obvious, the low-hanging fruit, the obvious things that you need to grab first. And it's so often we look at the disproportionately our campaign, we look at it through our own eyes, and we don't really, it's not obvious to us where in fact we need to make improvements. So I really hope that this way is a way of shortcutting that whole process, and it becomes, help people become obvious what they need to work on to get better. Mm-hmm. And also just, you know, a tool that people can self-improve. You know, these days, you know, we'll probably talk about a bit more about that in the future, but it's so often what I see anyway in New Zealand, that young kids, they'll want to just you know, go on the water if there's a program, and there's, you know, I think I brought up initially a lot of times that young kid who's a surfer, who's got no one watching him and he's got no pressure at all, and he still wants to get up in the morning and it's really cold and pull on that wetsuit and go out and catch a wave and learn how to surf. And I think I'd love to sort of see more of that happening in our sport as well, in a sailing sense. So bring it back to how it was. Yeah, a little bit nostalgic, but, you know, I think people can help themselves. And that's just what I really would like to see, is here's a tool where you can help yourself. And there's good information that can go out to every corner of the world. So, you know, we could see someone, you know, starting something and improving themselves in a, you know, very obscure part of the world, like New Zealand was, you know, when I grew up in the 70s.
Yeah, that's one of our stated aims with Road to Gold, is to spread world-class information around the world to other countries that maybe haven't had access to this kind of knowledge. So that's a work in progress for us. We've already got a number of people on board from some pretty obscure sailing nations, but we're very pleased to have you on board, and thanks for your faith in it. We've got so many more people on Road to Gold than have tended to come on these calls. So you, the hardcore that have been joining us for these live calls, we really appreciate it. It's been great fun. It is continuing for a little bit longer because we've got to find out how this America's Cup plays out. I'm hearing from pretty good sources that it's going to be a walk in the park for you and Emirates Team New Zealand, Hamish, but we've seen a few curveballs thrown during the Prada Cup, so maybe you won't have it quite as easily as some people think you will. What percentage chance do you give yourself right now?
Well, I really like the idea that the America's Cup has sort of gone back in a way, you know, to a bit of mystique. You know, there's not, you know, the challenger and the defender aren't really mixing it up. In recent times, we haven't been on the course with them since before Christmas. So, you know, I like to keep it that way. You know, that makes the whole first race, you know, really exciting. So, you know, let's leave it like that. But, you know, they're complicated boats. And there's, I think there's 3,000 different little things that operate inside the boat to make it work. And you only need a couple of little ones of those valves or mechatronics, whatever they're called, to go wrong, and you could have a failure, a catastrophic failure. So there's that, and there's also that tricky to sail. You know, that we're talking about capsizes, and we've capsized 3 times. So, you know, it's not. There's a lot of other things, unforeseen things that could happen, which keep us on our edge. And light air, you know, you've got to stay on your foils. We all know that. If one boat falls off the foils, then the other boat's going to win if it stays on their foils. And in strong winds, it's a matter of staying up right on the foils, and in medium winds, well, you know, there's still the whole race course. We've seen Ben, you know, do a nice job of winning races and pretend, you know, what might have been a slower boat. So with the boundaries there, there's plenty, it's plenty of that opportunity to happen as well. So I think we're going to see some good racing. I'll leave it at that.
All right. That's a good politician's answer. Well done, Hamish. But I was just looking at loads of comments and from email, and I just realized I've been missing this chat box. Well, thank you. You're going to make me cry, all these comments coming through. Really appreciate all that feedback. It's been a lot of fun. Looking forward to it at a slightly later time next week, Hamish. And I hope that all of you on this call will be back this time next week. Hope things are okay down under, Hamish, joining us in the land of lockdown, as we've been in the UK for pretty much as long as I can remember. Hope you have a good week, and we will see you a little bit later, but more or less the same time next week. See you then.
Sounds good. See you, Andy.